All right, welcome back. It is Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. I hope you like the bumper music. You got an extra dose of it there during the commercial break. But don't worry, everything's fine. What are you face-palming about over there, Dom?
First thing I learned in Bronx High School is just ignore it when things
what?
Go bad. Just act like nothing happened.
Why?
And then you
we all know it did happen.
When stuff goes sideways.
We all know it did happen. You know who came up with that is the person who kept screwing things up.
Yeah, but all
podcast
listeners
just act like nothing happened. Act like nothing happened.
Dumb. Let's go to the inbox. So many mistakes. Texts in an unsigned text.
Wide orbit crapped out. It's okay.
Two sources playing at once
are not going to know what happened.
Commercial blasts while hosts talk. You need some help, Dumb?
I'm just letting people know what happened. People are concerned.
Hey, there's Dom, there's 32 backseat drivers here.
There's more than 30.
That's true. But about 32 of them texted in. Anyways, we are back. It is Canucks Talk. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. We're live from the Kintec Studio. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver. Online at dunbarlumber.com.
So are we going to do a playoff matchup tiers thing or something?
Yeah, so yes, I think we should do that because that's one of the big talking points out of last night, right? For two reasons. We talked about it off the top a little bit, right? The entertainment factor and the concerns around that with a Kings-Canucks matchup. And then also just the fact that they've really, really struggled to generate offensively in these three games against the Kings. So we can focus on the first round a little bit, but I also think it's just interesting to kind of broaden the scope of it in the Western Conference too, because look, this team at the beginning of the year, maybe just making the playoffs and losing in the first round would have been satisfactory, but from this point on, it's not. You need to do more than that to make this, to pay off this regular season.
Do you?
100%.
Okay, well, let's start here. Let's start with the expectations before we get into ranking the playoff opponent tiers. You know, and we'll go, by the way, like hardest matchup to matchup you'd least like to see, all the way down to matchup you'd most like to see, and we'll name the toughest matchup the Dom versus the commercial break tier.
Next time you mess up, I'm gonna
Dom versus technical difficulties.
please feel free to. It's all good banter, right? Good bants, Dom.
Good bants, crushing Watts with good bants.
But before we do that, I disagree with you. I truly think, like, we talked about this over the summer, actually, on the Halford and Brough show, because I was guesting and you were guest
All
hosting
right.
and we weren't doing our program. But my very first column after taking, like, 3 weeks off in the summer was about expectations for this year and how I thought the playoffs were a false dichotomy. Like, what I wanted to see from this team wasn't, you know, especially given how they'd behaved, how they'd pushed assets into this season, wasn't, you know, the binary, if they make the playoffs, good, if they miss the playoffs, bad, but was instead, can you see it? Can you see a path from here to contention with the plan that Rutherford and Alvin have executed? And I think whether they lose in the first round or not, whether they advance to the second round or not, whether they advance to the conference final or not, like, I'm already there. This team's so significantly outperformed expectations, even if they've had a pretty average stretch over about 22 games now, you know, with the way that Pettersson has played, with the way that Miller has held up at the age of 30, with the way that Quinn Hughes has become, in my opinion, the best defenseman on the planet, with what we've learned about how to open up Hughes' game with puck-moving defenders, something the team was quicker to than us observers, to their credit. You know, with all of that sort of put together, with the way Lekkerimäki has popped, right? I think now you're going to go into this offseason, regardless of how the playoffs go, and think, hey, this is a team that, you know, has probably a relatively wide open 3 or 4 year window where they should be expected to make the playoffs. There's definitely challenges, but they've got the baseline level of play 5-on-5. They've got the high end stars, you know, to be a team capable of being a problem. And we were not there a summer ago. And I just think at the end of the day, you know, they could lose in five in the first round, and I'll still look at this and say, in terms of a from a vision perspective, right? What this front office did, which I was deeply skeptical about, has at least shown enough promise that this team can launch themselves beyond the mushy middle going forward. They've at least put that track down, and to me, that's way more important.
I just think
way more important.
That's fair, but first of all, I think the caveat is a lot depends on in the scenario where they lose in the first round. A lot depends on how it looks, right? We had the discussion yesterday. You can have close 4 or 5 game losses, right? Where, hey, you were right there with the other team and you just have a couple bounces didn't go
but
your
that's
way.
That's still going to feel bad.
It's still going to feel bad, but at least it's a close loss, right? But if they go out uncompetitively or just in like really unimpressive fashion, yeah, it's absolutely going to be a disappointment. And it doesn't invalidate the fact that they did take a big step forward as a team and you can see the path going forward, but it's still going to be massively disappointing.
See, I also think in this, we'll take
If you win your division and then you suck in the first round and you're like a President's Trophy challenger all year and then you blow it in the first round and aren't like don't even put up a good fight, that sucks. Sure. There's no way around that ultimately.
But it's funny because, and we'll get into this as we transition to ranking playoff opponents. It's funny too because this team faces Nashville in the first round and like loses in seven with deep bad luck afflicting them being the primary reason they lose. Mm-hmm. Everyone's going to be furious. They play Vegas and then lose in five, and people are going to be like, "Well, it's Vegas.
Well,
what
it's
a
the
tough
Stanley
draw.
Cup champs." It's true,
you know. So it's an interesting. At the end of the day, that's the perception stuff that we'll have to adjust to on the fly. But I just think
it's going to be a really tough pill to swallow for this team not to at least. It's going to feel so anticlimactic
if it happens. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm not predicting that it is.
No, I know. I'm not,
like, I'm going to probably pick them in the first round. I'm just saying, like, I get what you're saying about they've already cleared certain bars to make the season a success. It's been wildly more successful than certainly you and I thought it was going to be, and really anybody thought it was going to be coming into the year. That's all fair, but then part of that is as you get closer to the playoffs, the bar raises too, right?
Yeah, yeah. Of
and
course.
I think, I just think
they've already leapt over the bar I cared about and that I like set as the stakes for the season. And you know me, stubborn about my priors, I set a bar that I thought was incredibly high.
Mm.
You know, like I thought it was higher than making the playoffs. And I just think that we've seen enough that they've cleared it. Like we've seen just such a deep level of functional management. We've seen so many bets hit. We've seen such significant growth from this team's best players. We've seen such a world-class coaching job from Rick Tocchet. And we've seen this club, like, you know, find Hunter Brustevich in the third round and, you know, have Lekaramaki get back on track and then some, right? On and on. This team's situation feels so fundamentally different that to me, the playoffs are like a cherry on top and I'm looking forward to covering it. And I'm hopeful that, you know, young fans, especially who haven't seen the sorts of runs that we grew up with, get the experience of what that's like. But you know, for me, it's not going to be a referendum on the success or failure of this season.
It's going to feel like a missed opportunity. I think that's maybe the way that I'll think about it. Right. When you're this good throughout the regular season, you go out in the first round, you can put all the caveats you want, but it's going to feel, if it happens, like a missed opportunity. All right. With that in mind. So we can start with the kind of first round possible matchups, which not exclusively, but looking pretty likely that it could be either Nashville or Vegas right now. And your hot take, the Nashville Predators, the plucky Nashville Predators, who the Canucks have played really well in recent years, and including this year, scare you more as an opponent for the Canucks than the Stanley Cup champion Vegas Golden Knights.
Canucks are 3-0 against the Predators this year and have outscored them 13-6. So it's been deeply lopsided, but we also haven't seen this Predators team, right? Like this Predators team has come on to such a significant extent as the year has gone along. And, you know, remember, they have a first year coach, right? Like Tocchet had the 36 games last year, and then this team was able to hit the ground running. Nashville had Brunette from the jump this year, right? Like it's a little bit different. I do sort of wonder how much the Predators are a different team now than they were when the Canucks last saw them. You know,
I think that's a fair question.
There's also some profile stuff in the Predators, like in the some profile stuff in terms of how the Predators stack up that I think is fascinating. So, like, for example, Predators are a top five team in the entire league by both shot attempt and expected goal differential over their last 25 games, right? So are the Canucks, by the way. But the Predators are also second only to the Avalanche in shots for, right? And are, you know, I mean, they're not like a Canucks-level shot suppression team, but they're an elite shot generation team and an above-average defensive team. Like, there's some profile stuff that is almost reminiscent of last year's Panthers. Get hot at the right mm-hmm. time. High-end offense, right? New coach under whom you started a little bit slow and uneasy. Plus, they've got Saros. Plus, they've got Josi. Like, do they have Canucks-level elite talent? No, but very few teams do other than the Oilers and the Avalanche, right? The fact is, in my view anyway, is that Nashville profiles like a team that could be a real problem. And when we look at Vegas, we look at a team where we're trusting as mm-hmm. opposed where we're trusting what we've seen 12 months ago as opposed to trusting what we've seen lately. And by the way, I don't think that's invalid.
Well, and I think it's a flip side of the coin with Nashville, right? Where it's how quickly are you willing to update your impression of the team based on the last 25 games versus previous to that, and even going back to the last couple of years, right? Whereas Vegas, it's the exact opposite, or it's the same, but just how quickly are you willing to downgrade your impression of the team?
Right, and I think with Nashville, it's sort of an easy leap for me because I've changed my view of the, like, through 30 games, mm-hmm. you know, I thought the Canucks were a deeply fortunate team with with significant offensive holes, right? And then the Canucks started controlling play at a totally different clip. Their last 30 games have been really impressive, and I've adjusted my view of this team accordingly, raising what I think of their ceiling, and yet, you know, my concerns about their offensive game remain. So it's easy for me to adjust my view of the Predators, and with Vegas, we're looking at, like, 70 games, yeah. in which they've just been mid. You know, at some point, like, I don't want to... My hot take is I genuinely think Nashville's a more dangerous first-round opponent at this point. Okay, I'm willing to own that, but I don't want to leave Vegas for dead because to me that's the most volatile team in the NHL right now. No one's going to be surprised if they get like swept in the first round, and no one's going to be surprised if they are repeating in June.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, we don't know who's going to be healthy for them. We don't know how much any of this is real, right? Well before the season, like when the Oilers were my President's Trophy pick, I thought Vegas would probably sleepwalk a little bit through the regular season and be a totally different animal come playoff time. It's not like I've abandoned that take. It's been my take all year. But at some point, like, they're not as recently as like January, every time it was like the Rangers are in town, or Vegas goes to Toronto, or Vegas plays this upstart Canucks team for the first time. They just stomped those opponents, and it was like, okay, this team still has that gear.
Mm-hmm.
But as they've sort of flatlined, and as injuries have kind of mounted for them over the last 6 weeks, like, even that, when it matters, this team turns up thing has kind of been compromised. Like, this team's lost games to Columbus, you know, after losing four in a row. This team played Vancouver having lost three in a row. And you'd have expected them to really care about making a statement. And
they
were,
didn't. There were no
terrible.
Show.
Yeah. They couldn't even connect play.
Yeah.
And that was after, like, with, like, Hanifin and Mantha playing their first games. Like, mm-hmm. the sort of boost you expect from new guys. Yeah, I mean, we still haven't seen Hurdle play for this team. Like, Vegas is the most... Vegas is the ultimate wild card going into this playoffs. Not just from a Canucks perspective.
From anyone. Yeah.
From an entire league-wide perspective. This team could be unbelievably good. And they could be unceremoniously dumped by a superior team, especially if it's an Avs first-round series yep. for them. And we'll just be like, yeah, that team just didn't have it next year. Or
yeah,
this year.
And I think the injury thing is, you know, people are texting in, well, look, Vegas is going to be a totally different team once the playoff starts because of the LTIR stuff. And
so we don't know that.
That could be the case. But also, even if Mark Stone is active, we don't know what shape he's going to be in, how effective he's going to be. Same thing with Tomas Hertl, right? So... there's a lot of questions, I think, about Vegas. And then you just factor in, like, they're old and they played as deep as possible into the playoffs last year. And that takes a toll at a certain point, right? It catches up to you.
And you now have an Aiden Hill injury.
Yep.
You know, so it's not just Mark Stone's spleen. Like, it now might be Aiden Hill, right? And goalie injuries at this point in the season scare me a lot. They add a lot of uncertainty into a team's profile, as they should.
I also, I will say, like, I can see where you're coming from with Nashville over Vegas, because there's so much upside with Vegas, but there's also so much downside. And I can see them just, like, completely folding up shop in the first round, right? If they're not quite healthy enough and it's just, like, they lose the first couple of games, like, I could see that being a shockingly easy series for somebody in round one, or a nightmare. I think with Nashville, like, really, though, it could be.
We just have no idea what we're getting from Vegas.
I think with Nashville, I look at it as much as they have been so impressive, at least if the Canucks match up with Nashville, there's a sense that it's strength on strength, right? This high-flying, run-and-gun, offensive Nashville Predators team going against the Canucks, who have become an elite defensive 5-on-5 team in the NHL. My concern with a team like the Kings, and I'm very curious to see how this Stars game goes on Thursday as well, but with the Kings, it's like their strength is also the Canucks' weakness. The Kings are so good defensively, and the Canucks really struggle to break that down. Now, you could flip it around and say, maybe should the Kings have an element of that going up against the Canucks? Yeah, but I would rather be in a position where the Canucks can try to slow down a team like Nashville than try to unlock and break down a really stout defensive team like the LA Kings. Like, I think to me, that's just inherently a more favorable matchup for how this team has won and what their strength and what their calling card has been this year.
And it's fair, but, you know, the thing about the Kings is they generate shots. They're not great shots, but they generate a lot of shots. Nashville generates great shots, and they're still decent defensively. They're not a liability,
yeah,
by any means.
It's the playoffs. It's not like you're going to get a walkover defensive team necessarily.
There's no walkover defensive teams in the western side of the bracket anyway. So at the end of the day, what I can't escape is the way Nashville profiles, like, that level, that rate of generating shots, that makes you just such a danger. Like, high shot rate means high danger, right? High shot rate means lots of opportunities to score, lots of opportunities to come back. And again, I think about Florida, Boston, right? Where you've got the Boston team that relied a lot on percentages, and they seem to have that series in control time and time again, and the Panthers just kept finding ways, right? They just kept finding ways to grind out that extra goal, to tie the game, to level it up. Nashville just has more of that, like, potency. Whereas as hard a time as the Canucks have had with the Kings of late, the Canucks haven't scored first in any of those games. Like, there's a world where the Canucks score first in three straight games and just, like, you know, counterpunch the Kings to death the way the Kings have been able to do to the Canucks. To me, those are, like, yeah, it's sure, it's coin flip games, but a Nashville team strikes me as being slightly more dangerous given their just high shot volume.
And then the other thing is, then you get into, as much as I'm saying, like, I'd rather them play a potent offensive team, it's not like I'm, like, excited about the possibility of a Colorado or Edmonton matchup later on in the playoffs, but I think it's just going to be a really, really tough road out of the Western Conference Nashville stepping up, with Vegas and the uncertainty and the upside there, and then you're into the Canucks, Edmonton, LA, Dallas, Colorado, Winnipeg. Winnipeg's an interesting one. They've stumbled a little bit here. Wouldn't be a possibility until the third round, but that's an interesting one. Yeah, if there's any way they made it.
I think Winnipeg's a team that's punched above their weight and is sort of starting to come back.
I definitely take Winnipeg as a matchup at some point over Edmonton, Colorado, Dallas, 100%.
I guess my concern is does that description also match a Canucks team that's only won 12 of their last 23? Right? Like, that's the concern there.
All right, we'll take a break. Sean Gentile from The Athletic, our guy, joins us next. Here it is, Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz here. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at dleamc.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? The hotline is brought to you by Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning. The first call, the only call, and we now go to the Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning hotline to chat with our guy from The Athletic covering the NHL. He is Sean Gentile. Sean, what's going on, man?
Boys, that was the smoothest music that you ever played me in on. Thank you. Thank you very much.
We enjoy it. We enjoy it very much here.
It was actually in honor of Russell Wilson.
Canucks talk. Let's ride. So,
I love. Like, it's just, we have to start every
with the Steelers.
With, well, no, but only Steelers mistakes.
How choked were you, Drance, that Justin Fields ended up there?
Oh, so choked, so choked. Although I do think he'll just take the job by week six, and it'll be fine.
What do you think about that?
It seems like that's, I wouldn't be surprised by that. At minimum, they're going to install some packages for him, and we're going to see a lot of Justin Fields. It's been this is my serious NFL analysis here. You can expect some goal line packages out of Justin Fields coming up.
Sick.
Very exciting. all right, on to the NHL. We were just talking in the last segment. So the Canucks, pretty good chance, not locked in stone, that they'll be playing either Nashville or Vegas. With the way Nashville is playing right now and the heater they're on, and Vegas, you know, struggling for much of the year to really regain that form, is it fair to say that Nashville might be the more frightening first-round playoff opponent right now?
I think you almost have to say. I mean, who knows? This could change in a month or whatever, whenever we see what the Golden Knights look like when they're a little bit closer to full operational power, but I don't know, man. The Preds are scary. They've been playing really well, and I think for me, it starts with Saros, right? Like, I know Aiden Hill was great last year and blah, 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 but that dude ain't UC Saros. And I think the fact that, you know, there is the possibility that they run into not just an elite goaltender, but one that's actually playing pretty well, too, by the time the playoffs roll around, that would scare me. Maybe not quite as much as the idea of having Hurdle and, you know, Hanifin fully engaged and all that stuff, but it comes pretty close. Yeah, they're certainly a whole lot more interesting in that regard than they were, you know, 6 weeks ago or whatever.
Provided Nashville ducks Colorado in the first round, I'm gonna have a really tough time picking against them. Like, they feel like Panthers redux to me.
Oh, Nashville. Yeah, that, for sure. I think, I like them adding Zucker too. That just felt like, I know it's not like a huge deadline addition or anything like that, but he's the exact sort of guy that they need just to add like at least some other option in that middle six, right? Because you have Ryan O'Reilly playing really well. You have a dude like Tommy Novak who's really establish himself as a legit productive NHL player, you know, down the middle for them. Yeah, they're scary. And I think the question was always going to be whether they had enough pop in the lineup to really compete. And I think we've seen, you know, a little bit of an uptick from there over the last little bit, probably should say.
And with Vegas, you know, Drance used the word volatile to describe them, right? Where it feels like we could see anything from a sweep in the first round to a repeat for the Stanley Cup champs. Is that kind of where you are as well, right? Like, so much just depends on who's healthy, how much they have left in the tank, and maybe the last, you know, 4 months of uninspired play has just been a mirage.
I mean, they've been volatile. That, like, even when they were racking up wins at the start of the season, they were doing it in kind of a funky way, right? Where, not that it was necessarily unsustainable, but, you know, they were relying on some heaters and whatever else. Yeah, it's been a volatile season for them, you know, regardless, right? Just as kind of a baseline. And you throw in the fact that, you know, for as big of an acquisition as Hurdle was and as much as everybody loved it, you know, incorporating someone as quickly as they're going to have to with him down the stretch, that adds another, a whole other wrinkle of volatility. So, man, I'm with you. And I think, you know, everything's on the table with them. I wouldn't be surprised to see them go, whatever, 16-5 in the playoffs and do it again. I wouldn't be surprised to see them swept. I think there's a lot of stuff on the table for them.
Where are you at with the Canucks? I mean, you look at it since the Lindholm trade, and we're talking 12 wins. Mm-hmm. 11 losses, plus one goal differential in non-empty net situations. Has your view of this team, and it's mostly been rosy this season, despite your collaboration with Dom.
I would like to say, like I feel like we made this clear, right? Between the three of us, like,
oh yes,
over the course of the season, like,
everyone knows
he's anti.
Yeah.
I'm pro.
No, I mean, honestly, Dom was way higher on the Canucks than me entering the season. So, but yeah, I mean, I basically need theme music, you know, like very, very turned down for what, voice. But cape up for Dom, right? Like, that's basically where I'm at. Anyway,
love it.
Despite your close association with noted villain Dom Lucision,
yes,
you've tended to be pretty high on the Canucks all season. Has sort of what's effectively been like a relatively mid protracted stretch in any way altered your view of this club ceiling?
Maybe a little bit, but this is also always kind of. Most teams have a stretch like this during the season, right? That's just the nature of an 82-game season. Like, it's tough to play at a 120-point pace over the course of the whole thing. So, yeah, it's like it's lasted a little bit longer than maybe they would have liked. And everybody knows what the team's, you know, shortcomings are. And everybody knows what, like, the asterisks were, you know, when they were really playing well, right? Like, there's a lot of guys shooting in the high teens and low 20s and whatever else. But, man, I just still, you know, I still look at the top of that lineup, at the elite talent that they have, and I look at Demko, and I even look at Lindholm, who's like, I mean, whatever. Dude probably can't play much worse than he has at points over the last 12 or 15 games. And I just say, like, at some point that's going to win out. Like I know we just gassed up Nashville and whatever else. And that's legit, right? Cause UC Saros is scary, but coming into like a first round series against Nashville, you know, you make me pick somebody, I'm picking the team that has like Elias Pettersson and Quinn Hughes and Thatcher Demko and JT Miller on it. Right. Like, that's just the sort of stuff that I think I value. So
yeah it's been a rough stretch.
I have apparently not. Yeah, that's fine. Which is fine. Like, I'll take that. I'll take my chances. But yeah, like I don't know, dude. I just see those guys at the top, and it's tough for me to really pick against them.
Given where expectations were for the Canucks coming into this season, which was, you know, scrap for a playoff spot, be on the bubble, and where they are now, which is, you know, in the driver's seat to win their division, chance to win the President's Trophy. Does this already qualify as a successful season, or does the fact that they've been this good kind of raise the bar for what they need to do in the playoffs to kind of pay off the regular season and make it a successful season once the postseason starts?
I think like another version of that question is like, how many points do they have right now? I don't know.
98, exactly, I believe. Yeah, 98.
If they made it to 98 points, just in a little bit of a different and took a little bit of a different route, like if stuff was maybe spread out just a little bit more and they didn't have those couple tears that they went on, right? Yep. Like if the point distribution was just a little bit more equitable.
If November hadn't resulted in a statistical profile most similar to the 80s Oilers.
Exactly. Like if we were just spread out those wins a little bit more equitably over the last, you know, 5 months, coming in the season, man, if you say the Canucks have 98 points on March 26th or whatever day it is, you would take it 1,000 times out of 1,000.
Mm-hmm, yes.
So to me, that's the way I would frame it. I take that and say this is like kind of an unfettered, you know, unquestioned success. Then you factor in the fact that, you know, they lock up Pettersson. Like, I don't know. This is it. This feels like, I know expectations have been raised, and I know if they come in and lose in six to Nashville or whatever, people are going to be upset, and rightfully so. That's understandable. So it goes with raised expectations. But I still think, you know, barring some kind of major flame out down the stretch or in the first round, you know, this is, to me, this is pretty much an unqualified success on their end.
Yeah. A snow day campaign. I agree with you. I just wanted to check in on with you on awards voting. Now you're a PHWA member, but you won't get to vote on the Jack Adams. Do you think the Preds run gives Brunette a dark horse shot here, or has Tockett wrapped this up and it's kind of just over, and congratulations to Brunette and his Predators. Their late season run might make him a finalist.
So we do those we do obviously just like everybody else, we do preseason predictions at The Athletic, and we say who's going to win each award. I think I was the only person on our staff at the start of the season to pick Tockett. Like, I just felt like all the ingredients were in place, right? You have a good goalie, because that's a huge part of the Jack Adams Award. Typically, it's like you have a team that, you know, has a goaltender that's having a solid season, and maybe has, you know, also a run of shooting success. And I saw that. I kind of, you know, banked on that happening with Tockett. And the media also loves him. You know, you look at the broadcasters voting on that. That's not to be, that needs to be considered.
Yes,
right? And not to knock Andrew Brunette, because, you know, whatever. But there aren't a lot of guys around the league that are as beloved by broadcasters and writers. You know, just generally, when you talk about coaches, is Tockett. You know, he did the job for a little bit. I think that just gives him such a leg up over everybody else. And then you throw in the fact that, you know, there's always a narrative component to this, and people like to make up their minds on this stuff pretty early. You know, I think people just had in their heads after that run in November and then into the holidays, where it's like, where it felt like his to lose. And I don't think anything that's happened, even though, you know, they've been mediocre and Nashville's been great, and I know Tortorella was knocking on the door for a little bit there and whatever, I just don't think that enough has happened over the last month to really dissuade any voters. I think they're going to look at the early season performance. They're going to want to vote for a guy that they like, and he's probably going to bring it home.
Quinn Hughes, Norris, is that wrapped up, or is there some drama, especially with Roman Josi leading this charge for the Preds?
I can't see it happening, man. It just doesn't seem like, I know, and Josi's offensive stats are sick, as they tend to be, but I don't know. Like where was he at the start of the season? Like, I think that's where I'm at. And then you look at Makar, who's played, you know, dipped relevantly for a while there. It seems like it's Quinn's, and it seems like he's going to deserve it.
Yeah, it would have to be something very stunning happening, I think, for Quinn Hughes not to take over the Norris.
We'd have to see. There's however many games left. We'd need to see whatever, some kind of, you know, point and a half per game pace from Josi moving forward. It would be tough to.
I honestly think, and look, I'm knocking on wood and everything, but the Canucks have played 72. Like, if Quinn Hughes missed the final 10 games of the regular season, like, I don't think that does it. You know what
no,
I mean? Like,
I
think his lead
we're
is so
that,
strong. Yeah.
Dude, we're in that realm now, right? Where, you know, games played is relevant. Like, I've used that to make choices in the past, where I voted for a guy who's played 76 over a guy that's played 61 or whatever, especially with defensemen. I know there was one year where Mark Giordano got hurt, and I wanted to vote for him so badly, but I was like, this dude's played 61 games. Like, I just can't do it. We're like out of that window now, though, right?
Yep.
Like, we're far enough along where if Quinn, you know, breaks his toe tomorrow or something, then people are still going to, it's still going to be pretty justified to have him at the top of the ballot. Like, we're at that point in the schedule now for sure.
Yeah, it would have to be like that plus, like, yeah, as you said, like a 2 point per game finish for Roman Josi or something like that to even make it interesting. We've been so locked in on the Western Conference playoff picture out here, but I did want to touch just quickly on the Eastern Conference situation, because it's getting pretty interesting out there, especially at the top of the Eastern Conference. I mean, I know Jake Gensel has been a beast for Carolina. They've been playing super, super well right now. Like, the Rangers keep on winning. Florida had that hot streak. Tampa's kind of rounding into form. Do you have a favorite to come out of the East at the moment right now?
You didn't even mention Boston.
That's
like,
true.
Right,
I know,
right,
I know.
There too.
For a good reason.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Right. I mean, they're certainly not my pick. Right. Like, whatever. But you know, they're in the mix though there, man. You look at the top of the league just overall. Like, this is one of the craziest
it's
races.
It's black magic,
for,
though.
It's nuts. Oh, 100%. 100%. I totally, totally agree with you. Like, you look at that roster and it's just baffling, right? And that's, he's not going to win it, but he should be on ballots. It's Jim Montgomery. Like, how that dude has pulled that off you know, over the course of this season. It's not quite just Swayman being good either. There's clunky stuff going on there, especially when you look at that forward group and the left side of the defense. They're really good. But I don't know. I'm kind of a bad weekend for the Hurricanes. I think like on Thursday night or whatever, I'd have been like, yeah, they're the pick moving forward. But come out and lay an egg against Washington and just look a little funky overall. And I'm wondering about it. The Rangers, I feel like, are kind of, they've been there all season and they've gotten there in kind of a funky way. You know, there's a little bit of black magic going on there too, but man, Shesterkin's playing better. They're another team. They got some of the talent at the top, with Panarin's probably in the second layer of, you know, Hart Trophy candidates and all that. So I don't know. I'll go with them just because I feel like I've been sleeping on them a bit throughout the course of the season. Maybe they'll, you know, stuff it down my throat over the next 10 games or whatever.
Gensel as Gabarik 2.0 though.
Mm.
I find that an irresistible possibility. Your take.
Like prime Marian Gabarik is just, he's one of the greats. I had more fun watching that dude at his peak than, especially in that era, more like maybe is whatever, top five, top 10 fun factor player for me. So I don't know. I appreciate the I appreciate the comparison quite a bit. The dude fits. I don't know. Like he's such a guy. We talked about him.
Yeah.
I feel like on and off for the last couple months, just because of the Canucks connection, right? That dude is a really good hockey player. He's a really smart hockey player, and I think he's capable of playing, you know, several different styles and with a lot of different combinations of players. And I think we're kind of seeing that there. I love it. I love it for the stretch run. And you know, up until Friday night, I'd love the results on the team level, but we'll see. But I love the comparison.
Sean, appreciate the time as always, man. I'm sure we'll do this again, but before the playoffs. Thanks for doing this.
You know, boys, anytime.
That is Sean Gentile from The Athletic, weighing in on the Canucks a little bit and also the Eastern Conference playoff scenario. And, you know, good to get the kind of outside perspective on the Canucks specifically. And I think that point about the top end talent, like if you know, we're doing the discussion here in Vancouver of which team scares you the most if you're choosing playoff opponents, right? And how does Nashville line up and all of those things? And it's fair to remember that for somebody from outside the market like Sean, you know, if he's looking at it, that high-end talent that the Canucks can line up, that carries a lot of weight with people. And there's a reason for it. It's because wicked players win playoff series. That's what they do. That's why you want them on your team, because they're capable of doing that. Doesn't mean it's a, you know, it's a guarantee or anything like that when you're going up against a team like Nashville or LA that you think you have more high-end talent than. But we've talked about the defense, we talk about the goaltending, all of those things. I think it's still important to remember that they have those game-breaking players in a way that few other teams around the NHL have, with the exceptions, as you said, like Colorado, Edmonton certainly fall into that.
No question. It is, you know, just overall like an interesting dynamic to track. I think the thing that I sort of struggle with a little bit, right, is like you need the best players, obviously. You want to have the highest gear with your best players on the ice. But when you're talking about this level of rarefied air, right, it's not like you're going in with, you know, JT Miller, Brock Besser, and Pugh Suter. Please put him back on that line. And you're facing Jason Dickinson, Colin Blackwell, and
yeah,
Joey Anderson, yep, who, by the way, have somehow outscored opponents on the Blackhawks at 5-on-5, which I hadn't realized until today, and it blew my mind. I'm like, does Jason Dickinson have to be a down-ballot consideration for the Selke? I think he does. Crazy, but that's the world we live in. You know, you're going to go in and face last night, right? Anze Kopitar and Philip Deneau, or... you know, you're going to face that Philip Forsberg line in Nashville, and that's at the low end. Jack Eichel, McDavid, right?
Like, yep, Nathan McKinnon.
The top end matters so much, but I watched and I covered that Seattle-Colorado series last year, and the Avalanche scored two goals with MacKinnon not on the ice and losing seven. And it's like, yeah, no kidding. Right? Like, it's the rest of those minutes that matter too. So, you know, the Canucks gear, when they have Quinn Hughes on the ice with the Miller line or the Pettersson line, is one of the absolute highest in the league, right? Canucks, Quinn Hughes on the ice, 84 goals for the Canucks, 49 against. It's one of the highest outscoring rates in the NHL. But like the Oilers have a similar rate, right? The Panthers have similar top end guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Rangers with Adam Fox, like there's comparable high end. Like at the end of the day, it's going to be some of those non-star minutes that are decisive, which is why people who've watched these games for so long know, like, great third line. Often, you know, like, it's Ruslan Fedotenko making the difference in that crucial Game 7 because Datsyuk and Crosby are playing one another to a draw.
Oh, well, and I think it's really why the Canucks' depth situation and health situation is so important going into the playoffs.
Right.
Right? Like, I think you touched on this in your article at The Athletic last night, right? But all of a sudden, you know, Lindholm's out for that game last night, Joshua is still out, and it's Phil DiGiuseppe. It's
back,
you know,
on, yep.
Pew Suter gets bumped down to play center because they don't want to play Neil Zaman there. And Teddy Bluger moves up, right? So you're discombobulated there, and all of a sudden it looks way, way different than if you add those two guys to the lineup.
And you got a hightail outcome from your bottom six.
Yeah, the fourth line actually played awesome.
Awesome.
That's Sam Lafferty goal. That's like, let's go.
Stunningly good.
Let's go.
Okay, we...
The ghost of Rick Nash inhabited Sam Lafferty. Well, Rick Nash is still alive, but the spirit of Rick Nash inhabited Sam Lafferty there for a second.
I do think, however, that we have to retire the LOL Maple Leafs every time Sam Lafferty does something. I think it's time to retire that.
I mean, I'm never going to tell people to stop clowning on the Leafs, so go nuts. You have my blessing, everyone.
Yeah.
Even if it's unfair, I don't care.
Well, no, it's not about it being unfair. It's just like you don't want to dunk and be pathetic. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. dunk when it's good and called for. But if you dunk and it's pathetic, that's when I'm going to be like, I think it's time to stop that. You're embarrassing yourself. And that's where I'm
at.
You
want quality dunks.
Quality dunks.
Yeah.
Yeah, high quality dunks. Like, at the end of the day, you know.
You want to be Mac McClung, not Jaylen Brown, is what you're saying.
Beautiful goal. So sick. Love it. He's been a really great player for the Canucks. That was his eighth point in the last 41 games. Like, I just don't think it's a good dunk.
It was a sick goal, though.
Sick goal.
It was so great.
Very
the funniest
awesome.
Part about it too was if you watch the play, he picks up the puck, and it, like, as soon as he picks up the puck, it looks like there's a lane for him to turn towards the net and turn towards the middle of the ice, and he doesn't.
I know.
And I was watching in real time. I was like, that's frustrating. I was like, oh man, I feel like maybe if there's a guy with a little bit more upside, he takes that to the center of the ice, he tries to make a play. But then instantly he was like he turned to the boards. I was like, I feel like that's leaving something on the table. And then he was like, no, I forgot this. Just watch this.
So I had a different reaction. Were you there? You were
No, I was
okay,
watching.
Okay, so I think live it's a little different. Because live, I was like, oh, he has a lane. And he took the lane. And what I was sort of, I was like, oh, great move. And then as he was skating into the slot, I was like, wow, that's a great scoring opportunity. That's a great scoring opportunity. Still a great scoring opportunity, and just like waiting. And that was like goal scorer's patience.
No,
that
it was incredible.
Sick.
It was absolutely incredible.
And one other thing, the Canucks at their best score goals like that in part because it was Hughes who did a bunch of Woody Woodpecker stuff for like you're pinning the Pierre-Luc Dubois line for like a solid minute. And then it's like Pod Colson outmuscles Arvidsson. Pod Colson wins another battle along the wall. And then the Canucks have changed. The Kings are dead tired. And the Canucks are, you know, fourth liners are picking apart.
They have space. Space opens up, right?
And guys are literally like, you know, their brains stop working. There's lead in their lungs, like lead in their legs too. Like, it was just one of those. When the Canucks get cooking like that, they can be really dangerous. They didn't do it very often last night, but that was a beauty that resulted from, it felt like a bit of a signature goal for the Canucks. In a lot of ways.
It was a fun one, for sure. Yeah. We'll take a break. I do want to talk a little bit about Quinn Hughes, and more than just Hughes specifically, the defense pairings we saw last night, and maybe Philip Peronik's game and where it's at a little bit as well. So we'll do that on the other side. You can send your text in 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. Final segment coming up here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Big opinions and good bets. It's the People's Show with Bik Nizar. Be sure to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's good. I do. I enjoy it.
Thank you for the compliment.
I will say, you're redeeming yourself. Someone gave you 100%. A compliment after the last commercial break in the inbox, by the way, Dom, for nailing the commercial break after the technical difficulties earlier in the show.
It's more of a Bronx cheer than anything.
That's a good way of putting it. I'll admit, I was just like chilling.
I was looking at you like...
Laid back in my chair because I was waiting for a familiar music to jolt me into hosting the show, and this was new. I was
you
like,
know what
oh,
that
what's
means?
This?
That means you've just gotten too comfortable.
That's true. I'm in my groove. That's why I like to think
actually,
that.
Funny enough, this song is called African Groove 2.
There you go. I like it. It's a winner. It's in the rotation for sure. It is Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650, Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drancier, live from the Kintech Studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. All right, getting back into a little bit of the Canucks 3-2 loss to the Kings last night at Rogers Arena. One of the notable things going into the game is the new look defensive pairings that Rick Tocchet and Adam Foote decided to go with. And, you know, we've become so accustomed to Quinn Hughes and Philip Hronek together at the top of the lineup for the blue line. Last night, Quinn Hughes playing with Tyler Myers, Philip Hronek playing with Nikita Zadorov. Now, as the game went along, there was some shuffling there. And I think Hughes and Hronek were still on the ice together for something like 5 minutes of 5-on-5 time. So it's not like they were completely separate last night, but relatively rare to see them start a game and play that little together at 5-on-5 this season. It's funny because remember when that trade happened, and even after that trade happened and coming into this season, there was so much talk of, do you play them together? Do you need to see what Hronek can do on his own pair? What's the best way to use them? And the answer this whole year has been, no, we're just going to keep those two guys together because they give us that extra punch at the top of the lineup. But because of Philip Hronek's contract situation, I think there's still been a very understandable desire, certainly from fans, but if I had to guess, I would guess from management and the coaching staff as well, to gather a little bit more data on what exactly Philip Hronek can do away from Quinn Hughes. How much can he elevate other parts of your lineup? And I got to say, like, I don't think the results have been great when we've seen it this year for Philip Hronek away from Quinn Hughes. And look, a lot of guys didn't have their best game last night. You know, Rick Tocchet said we struggled to execute. 100%, that's fair. But it does feel like he's been a great fit for Quinn Hughes. There's no denying
he's
that.
He's been a
obviously.
Great fit for Quinn Hughes.
He's been an incredible fit for Quinn Hughes. I don't know that he's been an incredible fit away from Quinn Hughes for this team. And I think that it's fair to, if you're staring down the thought of signing this guy to an 8-year extension, I don't know if that's a deal breaker necessarily, but I think it's a pretty important data point that you need to have an opinion on it, right? Like, you need to justify signing that deal if you think he can only really help your team playing with Quinn Hughes.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is it's like, put it in a more familiar context. What we're kind of not used to the idea in some ways of like evaluating a defender simply because they're a great fit for a key engine of a team,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, Devon Taves is sort of the closest we
guy.
Come.
Yep.
And we know that Devon Taves is also a monster away from Cale Makar, but obviously that pair,
a huge part of his value comes from the chemistry, the fit.
He's definitely not a passenger on that pair. There's real synergy, mm-hmm. right? The
I would argue that there's synergy with Hughes and Hronek, and Quinn would say the same, right? He said it last night again. Now, I kind of think we're far more used to discussing it in the context of forwards, right? And like, let's do an example that's on the tip of everybody's tongue for really strange reasons over the course of the past week, which is Zach Hyman. Like, is Zach Hyman a 50 goal scorer away from Connor McDavid?
Of course not.
Does it matter?
Not really. And well, here's the, and the argument that always comes up, and this has been made with guys playing with Crosby and everything. It's like, no, it's not as if everybody who goes there does that. You know what I mean? Who gets that spot scores 50 goals, right? Like, you still have to have certain characteristics to play with Connor McDavid and know how to play to cash in on 50 goals. Of course, he's being helped by Connor McDavid, just like Chris Kunitz was helped by Sidney Crosby. But there's been a lot of guys who've gotten chances on Sidney Crosby or Connor McDavid's wings who haven't done that, who haven't taken the ball and run with it in the same way that Zach Hyman has.
Yeah, Alex Burrows, Taylor Pyatt.
Yeah.
Right? Thunder Bay legend. Taylor Pyatt, by the way, not Alex Burrows. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, like, I can poke holes easily in the Hronek thing, right? Like, for example, with Hughes, right, which has been over 1,000 minutes, the Canucks have, you know, outshot their opponents by 40, right? That's a 52.1% shots for clip. Hronek without Hughes, 42.8. Well, that's not very good.
It's not great.
Right? On the other hand, you know, 60% goals for with that pair on the ice together. Hronek without Hughes, 59%. Well, that's not a huge difference.
Nope.
Now, Hughes without Hronek, 72%. But that's probably, you know, for a variety of reasons. The sample's too small for that to be much more than noise.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the main hole you'd poke in it, if you were had any desire to do so, is the Ethan Bear thing. Like, the Ethan Bear thing is the thing that looms large here for me in terms of how I'd evaluate it, which, and you know, what that comes down to is, if you look at what Bear did with, you know, Hughes in like 500 minutes on a far less impressive, far less structured team, right? With far less going the team's way. So 360 minutes, Hughes with Bear, 56% shot attempts percentage. Hronek, 1,000 minutes, 56% shot attempt sort of percentage. 52% shots for Hronek and Hughes, 58% for Bear with Hughes. And then even the goals for, right? Like, Bear Hughes, 21 goals for, 13 against, right? If you extrapolate that and expand the sample times three, what do you get? You get something pretty close to 69 goals for, 44 goals against, which was Hughes Hronek. So, you know, for me, I think the main argument that you can make, if you desire to make it, is, well, if you put just like an average 4-5 level puck mover who's right-handed with Quinn Hughes, it still accomplishes an awful lot of the Hronek effect without having to pay Philip Hronek like he's a top pair defenseman. The thing is, like, I don't care. Like, I don't care that much about it. And
well,
I think there's...
It only becomes a big discussion after this season. Because for the in-season purposes, it's like, it's great that you have Quinn Hughes and Philip Hronek and you put them together. Like, that's awesome.
But also, like, Hronek's a bigger goal threat, right? Like, he's... he does a bunch of stuff as, like, the premium version of Bear that Bear doesn't. You know, like, there is value to having the guy who's just the perfect fit with your best player on the roster. You know, I don't think you need to galaxy brain it by going into this. And here's sort of where the rubber meets the road in this conversation, because the conversation dovetails with, you know, extension talks.
Yes,
we know that Alan Walsh met with Canucks management when the team went through California. You know, we've heard all sorts of numbers being thrown around, $8 million, $6.5 million, on and on. The dynamic is not too different from what we were talking about with Pettersson, in that Hronek's got this sick arbitration case, a ton of leverage, right? If he goes to arbitration, his 1 year award is probably higher than like a $6.5 or even $7 million valuation anyway. And, you know, I've been reading smarter people than me calculate, like, what would you anticipate at current NHL revenue levels with, you know, an additional like additional YOY growth, you know, if the lag formula is properly followed, given the elimination of the player debt stemming from the pandemic, like, could we have a $97 million, $98 million salary cap? Like, that's within, that's feasible in the summer of 2025. Like, this year we're going to get $6 million in cap growth, but it's the next year that agents have been eyeing, like, the people with real skin in the game who are paid extremely well to protect their clients' interests and maximize their income over a very short earning window as professional athletes. Like, there's a chance that we get $10 million or in cap growth YOY between 2024 and 2025. And this is the essential dynamic. Like, when you're committing as a player like Hronek, positioned the way he is, to a long-term deal, part of what you're selling is the opportunity, right? To not explore what could be out there,
yeah,
in a Mozgov-like environment for a right-handed defenseman who, you know, especially if he continues to be deployed the way he has in his first stretch in Vancouver, like, very easily could be, you know, a consecutive 50-point, mid-20s, right-handed puck-moving defenseman who a team might quite reasonably, in my opinion, too, think, hey, he could do more with PP1 duties given his right-handed blast and overall skill level.
And I think, as you said, the rubber hits the road when you start talking about contract extension, because from a hockey perspective, like, look, Rick Tocchet said after the game, hey, we're trying out some different looks, you know, different matchups. In the key moments, it's going to be Quinn Hughes and Philip Hronek out there. And we know that, and we know that they can play really, really well together. And for the next 3 months or whatever, that's what matters. But, you know, to circle back to your Zach Hyman comparison, right, of the guy who complements the superstar player so well and kind of gets a, you know, I don't want to say inflated, but gets a boost to his stats and his production based on that chemistry. You go back to the Alex Burrows and the Sedin twins example. The allure of that player is that you're getting a first line forward or a first pairing defenseman below market for that, right? That you're getting that product, like, star level production, because from a non-star player, because they have that fit. And that's where the question becomes for me is, you're going to be paying Philip Hronek like a star, right? If it was like, hey, you got him at 4.5 for another 3 years.
Oh, yeah.
That's
yeah.
a completely different conversation. And you're like, you're over the moon. Who cares if he doesn't play well away from Quinn Hughes? Just stick him with Quinn Hughes. But I think the question for me is, are you getting enough of a premium with Philip Hronek and Quinn Hughes that you feel like you have to match his asking price, whether it's $8 million, whatever it is, on a long-term extension? Is there enough value there to avoid going out and trying to replicate something like the Ethan Bear thing? Because that's a big part of the Zach Hyman story, right? It's not just that he has incredible chemistry with Connor McDavid. He's also making $5.5 million. Alex Burrows was what? He was on a $2 million contract. A very different cap environment, obviously, but for a long time when he was playing with the Sedins. I think that's like a crucial part of this formula is you get the bargain on a player. For it to be the best situation for the team, you get the bargain on the guy who fits well next to the star.
So to my taste, right? Like, I'd rather be the team that lets Hyman walk and finds Bobby McMahon, you know, or whomever to compliment Austin Matthews, because there's a lot of guys who seem to be able to do it, right? But there is a cost to that in terms of, you know, how good you are, right? There's a time to spend. There's a time to find the next guy up, right? And again, my taste, my biases is always you have to be confident in finding supporting cap players. You have to be confident in your ability to find supporting players. And by the way, we've seen this team do it. I mean, we saw them do it twice in 12 months with this type of player.
Yep.
You know, at the cost of draft picks and pretty significant draft picks. You know, I'd add this, like, we got a text in. Do you have an idea of the potential trade value / return for Hronek? How much has Hughes added to his potential trade return? Here's the thing, like, given the contract status, right? If you're in the position where you're moving on from Hronek without an extension in place before you do the deal, you're selling a rental. Like, there's a real chance.
You are, although...
You are.
Don't you think if he's... I feel like if he were to be traded this summer, it's to a team that's very motivated to sign him to an extension, right?
Almost surely. Unless it goes beyond that and you end up selling him as a pure rental. But, like... For the most part, yes, you're probably right. like, given the arbitration case and what that does to trade value, what I'd tell you is Hronek's been like a 99th percentile hit for Canucks management, and yet I doubt that his value has increased as a trade asset.
It's so, the man,
strongly doubt. Like, I'd be stunned.
I think it's held.
I would be surprised if they could net what they paid, and it doesn't matter. Like, what they paid has got them here. You know, like, part of the return now, regardless of how this plays out, and I still suspect that Hronek's most likely to end up remaining in Vancouver long term, because I think the team wants to keep him long term. And I think the fit's so obviously good for both sides that, you know, at some point, and there's so many leverage points with an arbitration eligible player too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're going to have so many different moments that effectively incentivize both sides to come to terms, right? It's going to be, so anyway, I'm just trying to go through this as a thought exercise. I think you'd be hard pressed to net what you paid. And yet I think the price you paid is worth it, you know, add 60% given how this season has unfolded for the Canucks and all that that's meant for individual Canucks players, right? You've got Hughes in position, pole position to win the Norris. You've got Pettersson re-signed. You've got the vibe around this team on the up and up. You're going to be able to attract players who might not otherwise, who you might have had to pay a tax to convince to come to Vancouver because they see this as a place they can win. I mean, there's all sorts of benefits that you've netted as a result of the success of this deal. So even though I don't think his trade value has, like, I'd even argue I don't think it's held necessarily simply because of his contractual status, it's sort of still worthwhile. You still do that deal. It's still worth the price you paid. And
I think that's the key point, because I get what you're saying about, you know, look, this was a signature move for them and it's worked out so well and they're going to want to keep him around. But you've reaped benefits of it. You know what I mean? You've reaped the rewards of doing the trade. And even if you do get a lesser asset return, one, you had this amazing season in the bank, and then you're also getting the return of cap space and flexibility, right? Now, look, we're getting very theoretical here. I just find it a fascinating situation to go into. And even as you say, you know, about his trade value, the fascinating thing about the cap going up is obviously it changes the incentives from a player's point of view as well. But if a team thinks the cap is going to go up that much and they think they can get Filip Hronek at an $8 million long-term deal this summer, right? If they trade for him, well, in an environment where the cap is like $100 million, all of a sudden that looks like a discount. Well, so could you be motivated to, like, hey, man, we got to get this guy locked up before that next cap increase, and then it'll look like a discount in a couple years.
And you know me. I mean, I think it's a mug's game to consider that the cap's just going to always
guarantee.
up. Like I've always said, I think that's a mug's game. But I also think it's reasonable to consider the probability, right? That the conversation that's happening around this player at the moment, is he a $7 million player, is he an $8 million player, like fretting over $500K one way or another, like $7.5 million times eight and Canucks fans are celebrating, eight times eight and Canucks fans are like, too much, right? Fretting over that $500K in a world where the cap, you know, where people in the industry are anticipating this elevator year where the cap could jump into the mid-90s or higher, right? Like, it's so silly, right? Like, we could be 18 months away from the idea of an $8 million defenseman being, like, a second pair guy is just the economics
just where
of the
we
game.
Are. Yeah. Yeah.
So
that's wild.
So to some extent, I just feel like that's, you know, the Hughes internal ceiling or what have you. You know, I've seen the reaction that Canucks fans have as Frank Saravalli sort of explaining some of this, right? And I think doing a fabulous job of it. And Canucks fans are sneering at it, right? You know, I think a lot of it's compelling from understanding how the business of this game works and understanding Hronek's unique leverage, right? As a player at this point in time, it's going to be a fascinating one to watch unfold. And yet for the short term, right, for the rest of the season, however they decide to use him, whether they want to see him away from Hughes, whether they want to see him with Hughes, like whatever, you know, at the end of the day, this guy's been a huge part of this team, is their minutes leader 5-on-5. And with him and Hughes on the ice 5-on-5, this team makes magic. period. Yeah. This team makes magic. Just
and that's
enjoy
where,
it.
And that's where he's going to be ultimately. And the one thing I'll just say is, and I think what makes this so fascinating, and not just this situation, this is obviously just the one top of mind for us here in Vancouver, but as you say, look, you can't just bank on the cap going up, and especially not massive increases. But at a certain point, you have to make a guess, right? You're like, you have to factor in what the cap is going to do into your decisions and how different players, what the guesses that different players make, the guesses that different teams make, I think is going to influence so much of what we see in terms of player movement this summer, the contracts guy signs, who gets traded, all of those things. It's going to be a lot of people trying to do their best to forecast what could potentially happen with that massive salary cap jump, you know, potentially down the road going into the summer of 2025. All right, we will leave it there. Another show, a crossover. We haven't done one in a couple of weeks. Very excited. We'll see how many big $5 words, although I have to agree with you, iteration, not a particularly complicated word. But we'll see how many you can drop
before
on Rick Dahlia tomorrow.
Before you break, what is with Rick replying to you when you use a quote-unquote big word? Like, you didn't even use a really big one today. And he just tweets at you with a definition of the word.
Rick uses them as learning lessons, I think, in Rick Talk.
It's so weird.
A good opportunity to expand his vocabulary.
Do you remember the one you used today?
If we're expanding our vocabulary, learning lessons is definitely not going in it.
He said teaching opportunity last night. He updated it.
Let's go.
He's like, he dropped learning lessons. He's like, this is a teaching opportunity.
Learning lessons is definitely the ATM machine of coach speak.
All right, we'll leave it there. Crossover tomorrow. Thanks for listening. It is Sportsnet 650.